Well, maybe the aliens are trying to figure out why we have emotion, why we care, why we love. Because a lot of people still do that, too. We'll be back. We'll take your phone calls with a special guest tonight, Lloyd Pye, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Lloyd, we have special roundtable discussions every once in a while. I've got another one coming up this Thursday with Richard C. Hoagland and a number of other heavy hitters. It's called God, Man, and E.T. And, of course, this topic with you plays right into it. You have a roundtable discussion that you participate in or will that's a little different, don't you?
Right, and I'm glad you brought it up. This is a very interesting new thing that I'd like to share with the audience and get some input from them, actually, because it is new. A woman in the Maryland area, Eastern Maryland, named Teresa Aldeo, has bought a bed and breakfast there called the Chaffinch House, C-H-A-F-F-I-N-C-H. And you can go to that website, www.chaffinchhouse.com. And she's bought it with the specific intention of creating, if possible, a place for people in our field to go and have meetings in a way that we've never been able to do before. What she'd like to do is have notables in the field like me, like you, like Michael Cremo, and like a number of others, come there once a month, 1 week out of the month, middle of the week, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and have that person be there, and have their three other rooms in the bed and breakfast, and three couples or whoever can come and spend those 3 days, well, 2 days basically, with that individual, talking to them, roundtabling with them in as much time as they want with that individual. Now, the first one of these is going to be next week, the 28th, 29th, and 30th. Now, one room is already taken, but there are a couple of rooms left, so if anybody would like to spend time with me,
I beg your pardon,
to arrange their schedule such that they could get to.
Are you soliciting for a date on my show, Lloyd?
Well, not for a date, no. But you know, I really think it's a great idea and a great way to allow people to meet personally, up close and personal, as Dan rather used to say.
Sure.
And I think if it can catch on and work. And she's not looking to make money on this. If she can break even, she's trying to give us a venue to allow the people to spend time with us. And what she'd ask people to do is to go to that website, Chaffinch House, Chaffinch House.com, and tell her who they would like to spend that quality time with, whoever it is. You know, we all have special fans out there who would like to spend time with us, and I know you have an enormous amount who would love to spend a couple of days with you so that they could just pick your brain as much as they want. And same thing with me or anybody else who's doing, you know, work in this field. So it's something that's new. If it doesn't fly, it doesn't fly, but she's willing to try it, and I would hope that our community would be able to support this and give us another outlet for getting together and spreading the word on a detailed basis to people who are willing to make the effort to spend time with us.
Well, I think once the word gets out about what she's doing, Lloyd, it'll be packed.
I would hope so. I would really hope so, because it's just one of the best ideas anybody's come up with. And I love these people who are just willing to put their money where their mouth is. They just, you know, she contacted me and she said, look, this is what I'm doing. I love this field. I want to help. I want to do something, and this is what I think I can do. And I thought, what a wonderful idea. Bring one of us in the last week of each month, and have whoever out there wants to spend time with us come in. It's a wonderful place. Eastern Maryland is supposedly one of the top 10 best small towns in America. She says there are all kinds of mansions from pre-Civil War still standing right within walking distance of the Chaffinch House. And it just sounds like it's going to be great. I can't wait. Like I said, it's going to be next week, the 28th, the 29th, and the 30th. So anybody that wants to get on board, there's still a couple of slots open. Contact her and see if it can be arranged.
All right, let's go to the phones now. First-time caller line, you're up with Lloyd Pye. Hi there.
Hello.
Yes, sir. Where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Riverdale, Georgia, just south of Atlanta, 640 GST.
Great. Go ahead with your question.
All right. Hello, Lloyd. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Hi. Pleasure to talk to you.
We've been talking for years, but over email.
Oh, really?
Yeah, man. We've been buddies for a long time.
What's your email address?
P. Whitley.
Oh, right. Exactly. Absolutely.
All right. Yeah, this is great. This is super. I didn't think I stood a chance of getting in tonight. But I just wanted to mention that the first time I picked up on Coast to Coast was in around November, December 97, 98. A fellow named Zechariah Sitchin was the guest.
Yes.
And then I met you about the same time, and it's been a wild ride ever since.
It can change your way of thinking, can't it?
Well, how about a question, though, okay?
All right. You mentioned around 200,000 years ago was the human, the real human thing, which
right.
agrees with Sitchin pretty much.
Right.
But I was wondering, you remember if you studied the Sitchin material, when they first created man, the first samples they came up with were sterile.
Right.
And they had, it was Adamu and Tiamat, and then they had to rework them, and they did some gene splicing at that time and came up with Adapa and Titi, which was considered the first civilized man.
Right.
And that figured out, I've been working on the Shars, the 3,600 years and all that. It was about 110,200 years ago was when the first civilized man. Could this have been the time that what we're looking at with the gene splicing, the 46, 48, you know, the base pairs, I've got a theory that that's about the right time for that to have occurred.
Well, we don't really know because we don't have nuclear DNA from that far back. So it's really impossible to tell at this point, but what we do have is mitochondrial DNA that clearly goes back into the range of 200,000 years. So it's unlikely, from my standpoint, the way I see it and understand it, it's unlikely that our mitochondrial DNA would change and our nuclear DNA would not. I think, personally, that the whole package came into being the way it is now, today, with us, at around 200,000 years ago. And I think, though, the 110,000, this is not to say that major changes didn't occur along the way and major refinements didn't occur along the way. There are some people that say we, as we are today, didn't really come into existence till about 50,000 years ago. I would challenge that just based on the mitochondrial DNA studies, but there could have been major improvements in the way that we've been talking about with the hybridization. If they could genetically manipulate us in the first place, they could fine-tune it as they wanted to along the way.
They may not be able to determine exactly if the star child is extraterrestrial, but can they determine beyond a shadow of a doubt that this creature was indeed all human?
That's what they can prove, that it's not entirely human. Now, what you will hear, George, is that just what happened with the Hobbit. They've got a creature that doesn't look human in any way physiologically, but it walks upright, so they have to call it prehuman. They
right.
have to, like it or not, even though it's clear it's not even close to human. Well, same thing with this. If we can show that it's not entirely human genetically, that it's got genes in it that have never been seen before on Earth in a human being, what they're going to say to defend their position is that, well, it's another kind of human we've never seen before, that's all. It's just another kind of human. But the people are really going to know at that point, I think. I think that the scientists are just going to begin to look more and more ridiculous if they try to defend the point past us showing that it's clearly not entirely human.
Next up, let's go to our wild card line. You're up with us. Hi there.
Good Good morning, George. This is Charlie. Good morning, Lloyd.
Hey, Charlie.
Hi. I'm over in Twin Arrows, Arizona right now. George, I got a pretty exciting solution for Lloyd and what he needs. But let's start off with a question.
All right, go ahead.
Lloyd, have you ever given Starchild a face yet?
A face? Well, we've done about five different drawings that you can see on the website, starchild-uk.com. In the first rack of slides that are up there, you can see we've had, I think, about five different drawings. But each time you get one that looks substantially different from all the others because they're all based on the interpretations of the artists. And that goes for clay modeling or anything else. We would like to have a clay model of the head done, as was done with the Kennewick Man, and they came out with something looking like Patrick Stewart. But, again, that's really open to interpretation, and who knows what would come out of that process.
All right, let's walk you down the path of excitement here. Let's say it's this year, 2005, there's a family camping out in the desert around Pahrump, Nevada, and the husband is a prospector. That's his hobby. He goes out looking for minerals. The kids are off playing, and they wander into a cave and find two skeletons. What would happen next in today's world?
Well, if the skeletons are human, nothing. If the skeletons look like the Star Child, then we'd really have the beginnings of a genotype, and probably we would have a lot more interest in it.
You're thinking like a scientist. What they would do is they find two skeletons out in the desert. They would call 911.
Right, the cops would show up.
Then who would end up answering the call?
The medical examiner.
Right.
Yeah, let's try.
Well, are we talking ancient skeletons or like skeletons with like clothes and skin?
I guess we wouldn't know, right?
We wouldn't know. It's a mystery. They got to solve the problem. George, why don't you introduce this guy and his material to the producers of CSI?
Oh, they'd love that. What a show that would be.
What a show that would be.
Good idea.
And he'd get publicity. It would walk through the stages of discovering what this stuff is, all the discussion, and it would end up with an ending of Twilight Zone.
Well, and you know what? They'd spend all this money for the pathology.
Bingo! And you'd get your...
Well, that's a great idea, but let me tell you guys a story. When it came time, some of you may have seen The Secrets of the Skulls, which was a documentary that was done about the Star Child 3-4 years ago by a company in Australia. And when they first called me, they said, we want to do a whole hour on the Star Child. We heard about this. This is the most interesting thing we've heard. This is great. We're excited. We want to do it. And I said, great. They called I think, Discovery Channel and got a deal. But the Discovery Channel told them, we cannot do just the Star Child. We have to do a show on weird skulls in general. So the Australians called me back and they said, okay, we're going to have to do one on other weird skulls. What do you have in the world besides the Star Child? And just what I told you earlier, George, the coneheads, that's it, coneheads. And they said, that's it? And I said, that's it. So they brought that back to the Discovery Channel, and they ended up doing, if any of you saw the show, they dealt with people with just plain standard deformities, but they did do the Star Child. They did open with that, and they did sensationalize it very much. But it came down to this. They said, okay, now who can we talk to who will say that everything you're saying is wrong? And I said, well, there are some people like that I can tell you, but what's the point of doing the show if that's what you're going to have to do? And they said, look, we are in the business of selling commercial time. We're in the business of finding subjects that we can use as teasers and as promos to get people to watch the show. But we're not in the business of scaring people and sending them to bed thinking that that aliens or Bigfoot or anything else is real. So at the end of every sequence that we show of material like yours, we have to have somebody come on and say that it isn't true, don't worry, go to sleep, and you're going to wake up tomorrow and your world's going to be the same.
You're okay.
So I gave them the names of those people, and that's what you see on the show. And that's how it is with every one of these shows. And a lot of people were very upset with the recent Peter Jennings show where he did good work in the first part of the show and then it just fell apart at the end. They have to do that. Yeah. That's the way the system works, or you don't get on the air.
Next up, let's go east of the Rockies. You're with us. Hi.
Hey, George. How you doing?
Good.
This is Albert from Cleveland and WTAM 1100.
Sure, Albert. Hi.
I have a question for Lloyd. What is his opinion on the virgin birth of Jesus Christ? And is that possibly... See, my belief as a Christian, that's just what I believe, Jesus is God, but I want to know your opinion on the biblical account of creation towards, like, my view about the biblical account of creation and the difference between your view and my view and what your point is on it. And I have another question. Genesis chapter 6 talks about the Nephilim, which suggests genetic manipulation, maybe between angels or if they're aliens or angels, and then the Genesis chapter 1 talks about let us make man in our image, about the Trinity and Jesus, suggesting that he might have been extraterrestrial or came from God or a higher being. And I'll hang up and I'll listen to your
okay.
Thing.
I'll let you take the second part first, Lloyd. The Nephilim coming down here. I think you addressed it before because it's very close to some of the things Zechariah would say.
Exactly. I mean, there's great detail in Zechariah's body of work about that. Those particular passages, there's certainly I cover it in my book as well. But basically, it's what the Sumerians said, that we shall make, you know, we shall make the Adamu. You wonder where the word Adam came from. There it is, right in the Sumerian writings. We shall make the Adamu in our own image, after our own likeness. And then you have the, you know, you have the things about the Nephilim, and it's clear that it's saying that they came from God, the sons of heaven, and all that. It's fairly clear that they were trying to say what the Sumerians wrote 2,000 years prior, but put it into more prosaic terms for their own time, but still leaving enough of the original richness of the story intact.
Think Jesus could have been an extraterrestrial?
I think it's quite possible that, you know, the way it's written is that the angel of the Lord came unto Mary in the garden. And, you know, you can read a little more detail into that than...
That could have been a visitation.
Than a virgin birth necessarily. I think that was added on after the fact, as it became necessary to change the shape of the church after the Council of Nicaea and things like that. It just always wasn't the way that it is now. It was something that sort of grew, and I think that was part of the growing mechanism. But there's certainly, I think, enough indication that he was a very, very special human being, with the old line, powers and abilities far beyond those of mortal men. So it's quite possible that he had some alien parts to him, if not a hybrid, if not an outright alien.
Let's not let Dan Brown from Da Vinci Code hear this theory. He'll be all over it with another book.
You never know.
And again, speaking of your first book, by the way, Everything You Know Is Wrong.
Right.
Can you still get that?
Oh, yeah. It's still available through iUniverse.com, www.iUniverse.com. In fact, they just told me that it is consistently in the top 10 of books that sell at iUniverse quarter after quarter, which was a surprise to me. But nonetheless, that's what they say. So a book of that age, it's like 6-7 years old now, but it's still, you know, all the material in it talks about a time that's so old it doesn't really change, and it talks about hominoids and Bigfoot and all of that, and that material has only been updated by the Skookum cast. Really, it's the only big news in that field since the book came out. So basically, it's still very valid and very, very real and fresh to people who read it. So that, apparently that's why I don't really promote it that much, but it seems to keep selling.
All right, stay with us. We'll be back with final phone calls with our very special guest, Lloyd Pye, on Coast to Coast AM. On our next Coast to Coast program, Nick Redfern, our guest. Now, Nick will bring forth some information about what he believes really happened at Roswell, New Mexico, based on some never-before-revealed testimony of military whistleblowers, eyewitness intelligence reports, and a large amount of cooperative evidence. According to Nick Redfern, it will surprise you. That will be on our next Coast to Coast show. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie, Lloyd Pye, our guest. Lloyd, what's on your plate next? What do you do these days?
Well, I'm going to go up and do that thing at the Chaffinch House next week, the roundtable that we're going to have up there. Then I'm going to come back, and after the 4th, I'm going to start the actual writing of the Star Child book that we talked about earlier, the book about the Star Child. I've been arranging the information and getting the sequences worked out right so that I can have a, you know, an accurate chronological telling of what's happened up to this point these past 6 years. And then we'll get that out, and hopefully people will respond to it and become even more aware of what's going on and how powerful the evidence really is. I think when you see it, if you get on the website and you see the slides and you see the evidence of where we are now and understand what we've been through already, it's a heck of a story. And I've been writing for a long time, and I think it now has enough oomph in it to make a really good book, and I'm looking forward to getting that out.
Have other skeletons been found in the area where the Star Child's head was found in the rest of the bones?
We're not real sure of exactly. We can't pinpoint the village where it was found because the lady died before, you know, making that information known. So we're not 100% clear on exactly where it was. We have a general area 100 miles southwest of Chihuahua, Mexico. So I'm not sure about that. We don't. As far as other skeletons being found down there, it would be a good likelihood because it's a, you know, a desert-type area where they can be preserved for quite some period of time. Anything like the Star Child? No, not that I'm aware of. Never in history that I'm aware of. And I've been through the books, and the experts that work with us have been through the books trying to find something that looks like it so we'd have something to compare it to. And there's nothing so far that any of us have turned up.
Let's go to the phones again. Let's pick it up by going to our West of the Rockies line. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Hi, George. How are you doing?
Good.
And how are you, Lloyd?
I'm fine.
Okay, I got a quick comment and then just a quick question. When Cro-Magnon Man and all that, they didn't let their different people breed, right?
Excuse me, what?
You know, they did.
Oh, they did?
No,
they're, oh, okay.
Sure.
Never mind that question then.
Yeah.
Okay. With all the research that you're doing on the Star Child, aren't you afraid of any repercussions from the government?
You know, it's funny. When I first started doing this 6 years ago, the first thing I did, the first week after I got it, I brought it to a big conference, the UFO Congress in Laughlin, Nevada, and I was fairly new to the game and new to the field then, and everybody told me, oh boy, you're in trouble now, you are going to wake up dead very soon. And you know, they scared me. I mean, they scared the heck out of me. And for about 6 weeks I was expecting to wake up dead every morning. But when nothing happened, I just began to stop worrying about it and just put it behind me. And I have to be really honest about this. In the whole 6 years, I have not had anything happen to me that I think was anything at all from anybody really trying to stop me to do this. I think that what has stopped me more than anything is just my own ineptitude. And, you know, of course, the reluctance of people to help and get involved, but there hasn't been anything official put in my way that I'm aware of.
Oh, okay. Well, I appreciate it. My cab drivers get a kick out of me. Oh, by the way, I'm in Billings, Montana. My name's Chris.
All right, great. Thank you, Chris. Appreciate you being part of the program. What do, when you speak at a lot of conferences,
right?
What do people generally say to you, not people within the conference, but people who are in attendance, when they hear your speeches about the Star Child?
Well, you know, everyone seems to be uniformly amazed. I mean, you and I were together in Santa Cruz, California last year, and you might have been aware of some of the reaction there. It's like stunning, but it's also, I think when it gets down to it, people have to look at this, and it's kind of scary because in the abstract, thinking about UFOs and UFO reality and all that, because you can play so many mind games with it, it has a very Star Wars quality to it. It's fun, it's exciting, but it isn't really real. You look at the Star Child, and you're looking at something that could very well be real. And when you have to confront that reality, or the potential, the good potential for that reality, even if you're in our field, George, it causes that little knot in your stomach to say, geez, the world is going to change over this.
Yeah.
How will my life be impacted? And I think everybody kind of draws back from it because it really, the reality of it, the potential reality of it is so frightening in some ways that it causes most people to really back off. Very few people say, yeah, right, I'm going to charge ahead and I'm going to help find out what this is about. Not too many people do that.
Has the skull ever been in a museum?
Not that, no. I mean, as far as on display, no. But I can tell you, of course, obviously, that if it does turn out to be that, then that's what's going to happen.
Absolutely.
It's going to end up in a museum, and it'll be like, you know, the King Tut mask or the Mona Lisa or any of those things. It'll be extremely well protected and watched after because it'll be the most valuable relic in the world.
Wildcard Line, you're up with Lloyd Pye. Hi.
Hello, George.
Yes,
Lloyd, it's Donovan. Traveling through Mississippi right now.
Hello, Donovan. Go ahead.
I've got two separate questions for Lloyd. One of them was when he first started off the conversation tonight, he said that a lady had found the Star Child in a cave, and the Star Child was buried with a hand coming out of the dirt holding onto the arm of a lady skeleton beside it, correct?
Right.
Not
a cave, but a mine tunnel, but otherwise correct.
Right. Wouldn't that mean that the infant or child or whatever was alive to be able to put his hand through the soil to grab the lady around the wrist?
No, I think what you have is a body buried with the hand sticking up, with the woman who buried it knowing that she was going to lay down and die beside it, and she wrapped its hand around her upper arm, and she just laid down and died. Now, whether she took poison or cut her wrist or cut her throat or whatever, I don't know, but it's pretty clear that given the scenario as the woman described it, and she was a child at the time of about 15 when she found them, but that's how she described it, and we don't see anything other than a death, a burial, and then a suicide shortly thereafter.
Oh, okay. I understand now. And I was also kind of curious. You said that what made the Cro-Magnon man, I guess, was the second, third chromosome fused together to be able to give us 46 chromosomes.
Right.
And I was wondering, is there any way to split that second and third to see what human would look like before that point?
We're at that point yet of being able to do that, but certainly in the future we will be able to do that. But now keep in mind, there are other things that were done as well to create us. I mean, it's not just that thing, that one event genetically that created us. There are other things done as well. But that fusing of those two chromosomes is the most obvious and the most inarguable point that indicates, along again with the 4,000 genetic disorders, that we are the product of genetic manipulation. I don't see how anybody can fairly and legitimately argue against that point if they're aware of the facts. And certainly any geneticist working today is going to be aware of that.
Biologically speaking, Lloyd, how did they accomplish the genetic alteration? Do you think they merely started to play with the chromosomes, with the genetic makeup of man in its egg state, or do you think they played with what might have been here on the planet first? What do you think happened?
I think it has to be done at the egg level, George. I think what they did was they just looked, because obviously they had the ability, they had some experience at doing this, so they just looked, you know, they combed up and down the eggs of the creatures that were here. That would be the primates. I think it's the hominoids, the upright walking primates.
Maybe they made thousands of them, maybe millions.
Well, they certainly had the ability to go in and tap the pool that was here, and I think Neanderthals were. And I think Neanderthals are a type of hominoid, are going to prove out to be a type of hominoid. And I think that's the one they used. So they got some of those. They combed up and down their genetic package, and they knew what their own genetic package was, and they said, okay, here's what we have to do to make a match here. We've got to combine these two. We've got to combine two chromosomes at least, so it's going to match up. So let's just do the second and the third. We need to do X, Y, and Z as well to make it work, but once we have all that done, then we'll be able to have a hybrid, and there's going to be some nipping and tucking, and there's going to be some, you know, some genetic alteration that has to be done in the fine points of it that's going to leave some garbage in there that you know, it's not going to be good for them, but what do we care? You know, it's not us. So I think that's how it happened.
All right, let's pick it up by going to our wild card line. You're on the air with Lloyd Pye. Hi there.
How you doing tonight?
Good.
Great.
Yes.
Gentlemen, Lloyd, even though clowns are basically dismissed, they're still invited to every birthday party.
Absolutely.
Exactly.
Not saying we're useless.
Unfortunately, no.
Yeah, exactly. No matter how many people are scared of them. But my question was, how does the DNA differ? Because you said you've done extensive DNA. So is the actual DNA different? I mean, is it, does the ladder like shorten itself, or does it make itself thinner?
What DNA are you talking about specifically?
I'm talking about the DNA of the skull you've discovered, because if the DNA is exactly the same, or if it melds exactly the same, could it be possible that within our entire galaxy, that DNA is actually the key to identify everything, because maybe DNA is the consistency to where we can interact with anything within our own galaxy or anything else, which would lead to, more so than anything else, maybe the fact of it's more dimensional and time travel rather than an actual space travel. That's what it could link to.
Well, personally, I don't see that. I don't see it leading to time travel or anything of that kind. But I do think that DNA is at the heart of the universality of the humanoid form being a head, two arms, two legs, a trunk, the way we look in general, but also the way reptilians look, the way grays look, the way, you know, anyone that has a humanoid form looks, the DNA is going to be at the heart of that. Now, as far as the Star Child being exactly like ours, the mitochondrial DNA seems to be. But understand, when you say that, mitochondrial DNA is about 16,000 base pairs long in everybody. 16,000 base pairs long, approximately. The whole genetic package in nuclear DNA, which we cannot recover yet from the Star Child, is about 3 billion base pairs long. So you go from 16,000 up to 3 billion. So while you can have 16,000 be the same, there probably are going to be very significant differences in the nuclear DNA package of the Star Child when it can be recovered. And as of now, we only have primers that are designed to recover human lengths of base pairs, base pairs long. So if we get to the point where we can create our own primers for the Star Child, and that's going to, again, require an awful lot of money and a strong commitment by somebody to get some answers about it, then we will probably begin to see that it's not at all the way human DNA lines up at the nuclear DNA level.
Let's go east of the Rockies. Welcome to Coast to Coast. You are on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi.
Yeah, go ahead.
Sammy, you talked about Mardi-Kampf tests.
Mardi-Kampf.
Okay. I'd like to know what those would yield, because I got the ability to listen on the air while I've been on the phone, and the last caller was, I just want to expand on that then. What will the Mardi-Kampf test land?
The Mardi-Kampf test would tell us whether or not the fibers and the reddish residue that are now found coming out of the cancellous holes in the case of the fibers and resting in the cancellous holes in the case of the reddish residue, it would tell us whether or not for sure that was any kind of fungi, bacteria, mold, anything like that.
So it takes care of the variable.
It would indeed take care, but understand again, we have the problem of, since it's never been seen before, there are no tools and no protocol designed to snip those fibers off or to scrape that reddish residue out of those incredibly fine holes. Understand, when you're looking at those slides on the website, you're looking at something that is about the size of your little fingernail and about that width. And look how it looks, you know, on the screen. And it's you see what we're up against in terms of getting in there and doing this work. It requires the creation of new protocols, and that, too, is very expensive.
But what about the Buffalo I just learned of that happened about, 3 years ago? That it was the first albino buffalo in about 3,000 years, or 1,000 years, I'm sorry. But what happens to that anomaly that happens once every 1,000 years? And how does
I would really question whether that was the one and only first white buffalo in 1,000 years, because, frankly, albinism is a genetic defect across a wide spectrum of species, including reptiles. I mean, we have albino alligators at the zoo in New Orleans. So albinism is a very common, really common genetic defect across a very wide range of species, including gorillas, primates, remember Snowflake in the Barcelona Zoo, et cetera. So I don't really buy that, frankly. It may be a legend, and that may be part of the legend, but I would suspect that probably in Buffalo Bill's time, there were white buffalo running around out there.
Final call or so. Let's go to first-time caller line. Hi there.
Hi, my name is Paris. I'm calling from New York City.
Hi,
I'm a Native American shaman and interdimensional healer. Comment I wanted to make on about being abducted by these aliens. The helmets that were mentioned earlier in the program.
Yes.
They are...
That's on another hour I had, Lloyd, not yours.
Okay. Yes, yes. But also in retrospect to what we're talking now, there are other ways of protection. In my own experiences and my own memories, my memory of past live encounters and this life encounters with extraterrestrials, there are other natural forms of protection where... that are kind of birthrights, if you will. So, you know, this temporary protection where you wear some kind of instrument around the head, it'll only protect you at some level where they can't abduct you. They're still able to enter your home. They're still able to injure your animals. They're still able to enter your auric environment. The more natural forms of protection are ways that are not being lived on this planet. In some forms, yes, like Native American traditions, shamans, some tribes in Africa, Asian traditions.
Yeah, some of them, they get that. Can you imagine the initial fright, Lloyd, when these beings came down and these creatures that were on this planet at the time spotted them?
Well, yeah, I can hardly imagine it. Well, those creatures, I don't know that they would think anything more than a Bigfoot does today when they see
a human being. Yeah,
that probably the natives of the villages that were human beings, let's say 1,000 years ago, that were getting these beings put into their midst, I think they probably had an extreme pucker factor going when they saw the ship come down. So,
hey.
Yeah. I do think so.
Lloyd, good luck. Give us updates as soon as you get them, okay?
Okay, thank you very much, George, for having me.
That's Lloyd Pye. And by the way, the Roundtable Bread and Breakfast is going to be linked up, that website, on the coasttocoastam.com website. For Karis Coburn, Dan Galante, Steve Carr, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesur, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM, I'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.